Hello, and welcome to The Collision, Collider's podcast about movies, TV, and more. I'm Matt Goldberg, the site's managing editor, and with me today are associate editors Adam Chitwood.
Howdy.
And Dave Trumbor.
Hello.
We are also joined by the site's TV editor, the lovely and talented Allison Keene.
Hi.
Today we'll be talking about the new model of television, and because TV isn't really so much my forte, I like it, I watch it, it's all good, but I feel that the particulars of this episode could best be laid out by Dave. So, Dave, would you just take it away?
Yeah, we're going to focus a little bit on TV today, and like Matt mentioned, sort of the changing landscape of how content is produced, how it's paid for, because advertising is a huge part of things. But because of the way this model looks like it might be changing with the advent of new digital platforms, online media, some more independent productions and creations, we're just going to kind of take a look at that, see where we've come from, where we're at in this transition, and where we're going to go. There's actually been a lot in the news lately with the Television Critics Association conference going on currently. It seems like every year something comes up, there's some sort of dispute between the content creators, so the network, CBS, NBC, ABC, the cable companies as well, and then the distribution wing of things. So in this particular case, Time Warner Cable and CBS are having a bit of a tiff, and they have not resolved that yet, and that's definitely impacting consumers, but I think it also leads into our discussion today about how this landscape is changing. And then Adam offline made a point about the recent Emmy nominations and sort of the spotlight that Netflix and then also Hulu, even Amazon Prime, those types of digital platforms are getting now. They're getting a little bit more prestige, even if they're not exactly receiving the same amount of money that cable companies and network companies have. So all of this, we're going to try to tie it together and just go into a discussion about how this landscape is changing.
Okay, so to start off, let's break it down very simply. Where has TV been? Let's say, I would say up until maybe the last decade or so, it was a model we all understood. There was TV and there was cable, and then there was premium. Network television everyone got, cable could be a little raunchier and you paid for a lot of channels and you didn't get to choose and you just got all of them. And then if you had more money, you would buy HBO or Showtime, and sometimes those would come packaged together. So HBO and Cinemax might come in a package together, or Showtime and the Movie Channel. And that's right, I remember the Movie Channel. And like those might become packaged together. So that was the way it was. And then it felt like now that people could record their TV shows and things started getting – digital just messed everything up because now, you know, you could put TV shows on DVDs, which was great. And I just want to say I like thinking back to the time when in like one season of a TV show cost like $100 for like 22 episodes.
Yeah.
Like, and not even that. If it was like an HBO show, like I remember like a season of Carnival, which is like 10 episodes, costed $100 because it's like, we're HBO. Where else are you going to get it? And then sort of – people are like, well, I can get it on the internet when I download it illegally. And that sort of touched off a bit of an arms race where studios are like, okay, first off, the DVD market is drying up. Secondly, people are just taking this, so we need to offer it at a competitive price. But now this seems to have led to people being like, whoa, 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 whoa. The a la carte model that was never going to get offered because it's not tenable, and Allison sent us some great articles about why a la carte is actually a bad thing. And for the a la carte means you can choose the channels you want rather than bundling them all, buying a bunch of channels together. But really, we can really do that now because someone who cuts the cord, rather than paying $100 a month for cable, says, well, I only watch these shows, so I'm just going to pay $2, get the episode of the show I want, and at the end, I've paid like $22 and I now own this entire show. I can watch it at any time. So that's changed, and then we have Netflix with a whole streaming option. Plenty of studios have not only, I don't want to say forsaken their DVD market, but they've basically said, you know, that it's more profitable to sell the licensing rights to something like Lost rather than count on people buying those DVDs. If they want the DVDs for the special features, great, but now you can really just get that on Netflix or Xfinity or Amazon Prime. So that's all laying out there. So it has definitely become more complicated, and there is these new distribution models. And so, again, I step back and where Allison, you're our TV editor. Where do you see the lay of the land right now? What are your thoughts on it?
You touched on so many things there. That
Sorry, I didn't mean to. I was trying to, like, give, like, a little history lesson just to, like, bring us to the current date. And even then, I felt like I only scratched the surface. So I apologize.
Well, no, but you started off saying about how TV has changed. And I think it's interesting to note that the first real change that I think all of us would remember and our generation would really remember is 1999, The Sopranos picked up 7 Emmy nominations for HBO. And that really changed the game for HBO, because after that, that's when they started becoming these award-centric content producers, right? I mean, every year, it's like you just expect HBO dramas to end up as in the best drama category at the Emmys, right? But eventually, in the last few years, their subscription base has not really grown all that much, and they really aren't on the cutting edge of innovation. At the same time, you also pointed to diminishing DVD sales and things like that. And that's when Netflix kind of jumped in immediately and said, okay, well, we'll provide, you know, DVDs through the mail instead of the brick and mortar stores. And now we'll allow, you know, streaming, and we have these deals with certain networks or certain content producers where we can get, you know, cheaper deals on things and offer them to our subscribers. And then they realized that they could make even more money potentially by becoming content producers themselves. And that's where now, in this last round of Emmy nominations, Netflix picked up, hold on, wait for it. I have my stats here.
I thought you were trying to build anticipation. I didn't know you were looking for something.
14 Emmy nominations for Netflix. And this is the first time for, you know, House of Cards being nominated in the best drama category. I mean, this is the first time that an online-only program has even been nominated for an Emmy. And that just puts the broadcast networks to shame, you know? I mean, and this, so this year, we've changed the model again. And Netflix has become this, you know, at the vanguard of these changing ideas about how people not only want to pay for their TV services, but also how they consume the shows themselves. I mean, Netflix, as we all know, puts all their entire first season of each of their shows out at once, so you can watch it whenever you want. And that also ties in to the ratings game, which Netflix doesn't even play. They don't release any viewership data at all. They don't, and it, some people initially were like, oh, well, it's because they're going to be really embarrassed if, like, no one's watching House of Cards when it comes out, you know. But now it's more of a thing where it's like they don't have to release any viewership data because they don't care. Because as long as people are still paying their subscriptions, as long as they're still getting new subscribers, they don't really care when you watch your content. It's just that you do.
Well, also, Nielsen ratings are used to determine advertising prices.
Exactly. And that's why this is so different in that. I think this is something Dave wanted to talk about too, but you now have 3 different tiers of content producers. You have the broadcast networks who are, you know, completely tied in with advertising, and people don't really seem to mind. That's another thing, and I would get into that more later, but, and that has to do with bundling as well. But then you have these content producers who, like AMC and FX, who chase the Emmy nominations and stuff like that, and they found that viewers feel that their viewing experience is actually diminished by ads. These are different viewers than broadcast. And then you have, you know, HBO and Netflix, who don't have to worry about ads at all, and they're able to do all these things that AMC and FX wish that they could.
Nudity. So,
they can also alter their running times. It doesn't matter if an episode's 61 minutes or 55 minutes. Like, I remember Sorkin talking about The Newsroom and how different it was that, you know, he could turn in an episode that could be a little over and they were fine with it. So,
and he doesn't have to worry about commercial breaks either.
Yeah, so the creators have a little bit more freedom there too.
Exactly. And so all of this stuff ties back in together. It has to do with bundling. It has to do with video on demand. It has to do with all these things. They're all connected. And I will now let someone else wax on about that.
I mean, it's interesting that you brought up the advertising wing of these things, too. I was actually going back to even before that landscape changed, actually in the legislative wing, which we usually don't talk about too much on this show because it rarely has anything to do with our topic of conversation. But just going back at how Congress has kind of provided different legislation over the years for at different times regulating and then deregulating how these cable companies are able to provide content to the consumers. So in terms of what they're able to provide, the material that you actually see, which goes back to what you guys were talking about, the ratings. So a lot of that was regulated by legislation. And then up to the point of, you know, breaking up monopolies, making sure that there are is equal opportunities and competition is fostered in each market. And then in 96, this was set in 84. It was changed a little bit in 1992. And then in 96, there was this move to sort of deregulate that area and just kind of let the cable companies go back to whatever they wanted to do. And at that point, it was sort of a fostering of a capitalistic sense of we're just going to let competition sort these things out. And I don't think that's really changed since then, at least not with legislation. What some people have put forward, John McCain being one of the biggest proponents of this, he wants to see an a la carte, not only option, but sort of a forced offering from cable companies. And I don't think that was, I don't know where the status of that is. I don't know if it was shot down completely, if it's completely off the table now, or if it's still sort of in the works. But the interesting part of that is that a lot of these, so these articles that we read about why a la carte offerings wouldn't actually work, but then they come back and they say like, well, actually a la carte would lead to more competition. So basically the idea of a la carte is rather than you getting these bundled, packages of programs and channels, so you know 178 channels that you only watch three or four of. Like Matt said in the introduction, you would only pay for the ones that you were interested in. The problem with that is once that offer becomes available, each of those companies can increase that channel to the price for that channel, that subscription, to pretty much whatever they want. And that is why a lot of opponents of the a la carte method say that it wouldn't work. However, a lot of them seem to forget that competition of a free market in that situation would actually probably lower each of those prices. Because if you have competing channels, competing content programs, the one that's cheaper is probably going to win. So that's an interesting idea and an angle to kind of take forward. And it looks like the digital things like Netflix and Hulu, which are way, way cheaper month to month than the entire cable bundle, it looks like they're kind of trailblazing in that general direction. And like you guys mentioned earlier, they're also doing it at a quality level too, because now they're starting to get awards recognition and they're getting a lot of big names to come to their programs too. And this original content is really posing a threat to the broadcast companies that have been operating the same way for decades now. So it's just a really interesting landscape. And I don't know if you guys have any further information or directions that you want to take on it, but I just wanted to make sure that point was stated as well.
Well, mentioning about the a la carte, there's one point that was made in a Washington Post article about the fact that that model might be most harmful, the direct quote is, model might be most harmful to consumers with niche interests as channels with the smallest audiences are no longer able to cover their costs. Right. And that goes back to ratings. And you look at companies like, or cable companies like AMC, who have very low viewing numbers. I mean, Mad Men, I think season 5 premiere was one of their highest of all time, but for the most part, shows like Breaking Bad and Mad Men and things like that, with the exception of Walking Dead, that has been an anomaly, but they don't have many viewers that are live viewers. And the same is true with HBO. I think there was a stat that said Game of Thrones was leveling out at about 3 million viewers a week, which is huge for HBO. Mm-hmm. It rose to about 9 million eventually, but if any show on broadcast had 3 million viewers, it would be canceled immediately. Right. Under the Dome, for instance, has like 10, 11 million viewers a week. And that's why CBS is crazy about that. We'll get into that later. Mm. But it's the sort of thing where it sounds good, but then you realize that most people want to watch 2.5 Men. They don't want to watch Mad Men. So you would get people paying for broadcast networks and things like that, but not necessarily for content producers that we might say critically are producing some of the best content. However, Netflix is sort of changing that, but I'll let Adam speak because he's been
crowded him out.
Well, you kind of bring up an interesting point because I mean, we've known for years that the Nielsen rating system is inaccurate, and this has been a problem that's been looming large over the networks for a long time because no one can admit it. Because if the networks admit that the Nielsen ratings are inaccurate, then their advertisers don't know, like, how to spend their money. And then, so they're saying, like, oh, this show's actually lower. And then if the advertisers admit that they're inaccurate, they can't figure out how to, you know, portion their money towards – you know, which series to buy more, which networks to buy more ad time on. And I think that's why we're seeing, I mean, we're seeing the rise and the advent of kind of Netflix and, you know, on demand and stuff like that. And it's because, like, they can't really figure out how to do these ratings. And so it turns out that ratings don't matter. Like, The Bridge, for instance, was tabulated up 88% when you when you formulated the Live Plus 7 ratings, which is people who watch a recorded version of it within a week of it airing. And, you know, I think
quick question, Adam, just and when they say they watched it, do they know that they watched it, or is it just like this was saved to somebody's DVR?
No, they can, like, track when shows are deleted.
Okay, and, got it. That's because that obviously changes the game a little bit, because anyone can stock up on DVR, but doesn't
you're
watching the show. I'm sorry. Continue.
We've just seen this massive issue of how to measure ratings and get advertising dollars, and I think Netflix is kind of circumventing that. And that also ties into, I think, the fact that we're seeing a rise of Netflix and cable channels has to do with the movie industry as well, because you're seeing, you know, the $30, $40, $50 million drama doesn't exist anymore, so filmmakers are moving to television. Netflix did it the right way. When I first heard Netflix was doing original content, I was kind of wary, but they right off the bat, they got Fincher. He went way over budget on House of Cards, and they were like, you know, it's fine. Like, they had to.
Well, they have to. Netflix doesn't produce any of its own content, and eventually everyone else can just pull the plug on it. It's not just expanding. It's surviving for them.
But they spent $100 million on House of Cards.
They had to.
Sight unseen, which is a crazy idea.
I mean, for their long-term health, they had to. But, Adam, you're right. They had to get top talent to make sure it worked.
Yeah, and then, you know, you have Arrested Development, which didn't hit as well as I think people were hoping. It got kind of a mixed response, but then out of nowhere came Orange is the New Black, which was not even on my radar, but everyone is talking about that now. So they've got three solid hits, and they've kind of solidified themselves as a
but
place.
But no love for Lilyhammer.
or Hemlock Grove.
I'm sorry, go on.
No, but yeah, Hemlock Grove actually got two Emmy nominations, Adam, you just touched on something there about the fact that people, the buzz that's generated by these shows, like Orange is the New Black is a great example of the fact that it wasn't on anybody's radar, really. But once people started talking about it and it started generating this buzz, then people started, you know, checking it out and wanting to see it. And the same is true with HBO shows as well. I mean, the first season of Game of Thrones, the first season of True Blood, they had very, very, very low ratings. But once people, you know, word spread and people could watch them on the video on demand platforms, or they could watch them, you know, on reruns or whatever, then it started becoming this sort of, and that's exactly what Netflix and HBO and Showtime and those cable providers bank on. And it's something that I think the president of Netflix was saying, that he thinks that the idea that you have to wait and watch your show at 8 o'clock on a Wednesday night is the old way, and that is going to change because people don't want to wait. And that also is not a great idea for the network when if the show does generate buzz, there's no way for people to go back and catch up necessarily, you know, because it's not all there. They have to wait until the reruns come on in the summer. They have to wait until the DVD is released. So I think that's an interesting point as well.
Yeah, we're definitely in a culture that everybody wants just immediate satisfaction and nobody wants to wait for anything. So any
which is
model.
A huge cultural critique, but we have.
Oh, yeah, I mean, that's
show.
A whole other topic. I don't. Just putting that forward doesn't mean I necessarily agree that that's a good thing, but that's where we are. Right. So any model that is beholden to the old ways of sticking to the, you know, printed TV guide schedule of everything locked into those blocks of time, I don't think is going to be around for too much longer, relatively speaking. So I think it's just going to go in the advent of programming on demand when you want it, when you need it.
The other thing about bundling and about HBO in particular, and why Netflix is so different from HBO, because they're actually quite similar in so many ways, but that Netflix stands alone and HBO is a rider that comes potentially if you want it with the rest of your cable bundle. And you cannot get HBO, you cannot get Showtime or Cinemax or any of the other premium cable companies unless you already are signed up for a cable bundle.
Right.
And a lot of people have been talking about HBO Go, which is sort of Netflix-ish because it has the entire HBO library available. But you have to already be an HBO subscriber, therefore already a cable subscriber.
Or use that one guy's username and password that everyone in the world apparently uses.
That's what interests me is that, you know, Netflix isn't releasing its data, but I know so many people that just log into whoever's Netflix or whoever's HBO Go to watch these shows. Like, the buzz is high, but I think it's smarter than not to release the data because I think if you actually looked at it, it would be like a lower percentage of like actual more subscribers because everyone can just, you know, like, hey, what's your Netflix password? And you just have it, and it doesn't hurt that other person to share it. So I think that's an interesting thing to take into account as well.
Yeah, I don't think that they've quite gotten a grip yet on how to control that content from being shared. But then again, you can go over to someone's house and, I mean, you know, watch AMC and watch FX.
True.
But I actually have to get up and go and then spend time with them. And that's
you can just Skype and he'll just point the camera towards the TV and you're set.
Yeah, that's not so bad.
It's so sad that probably happens.
That's the whole basis of, what is it, Justin TV? People just record TV, like, through a little video camera.
Yeah, and then other people just log in and watch it, yeah.
And they go, stop changing the channel.
And we talk about a me first, want it now society. Pish posh. Yeah. So, in going forward with this, the amount of selection that people have, I actually am sort of fascinated by this, the entitlement of it in the sense that not in the I want it now, but sort of the if you don't want it now, you're going to get left behind. Because in the age where there's Twitter and Facebook and everyone just wants to talk about everything as quickly as possible,
mm-hmm.
I personally felt like not just because I was reviewing reviewing House of Cards and reviewing the fourth season of Arrested Development, that I had to binge watch it. Like, I just had, because I was like, oh my god, someone on Twitter is going to say something. And I actually felt I had to binge watch Orange is the New Black,
mm-hmm.
which wasn't horrible. I mean, I was into the show. But, like, freaking Patton Oswalt, he's like, I see a screwdriver in this thing. It's like, it's in the lab, and like, stop it! Stop it! Don't tell me to focus on this one thing. You should know better. That's just, but it's something where people, they want us to start talking about it. And at least when we had it on a week-by-week basis, we were like, okay, it's on this day. If I can hold off and just, I'll know. But like now it's all on our own time. And I'm not saying like, you know, I don't want to get into spoiler phobia,
mm-hmm.
but I'm more interested in how do we discuss television when it's on our schedule instead of the network schedule?
Well, look, I think you have to look at it this way, too, that it's no longer just, like, an American problem or even just, like, a Pacific versus Eastern time zone problem. This is a global thing now. I think a really good example of that coming out is the Doctor Who 50th anniversary special that's coming out, I think, Saturday, November 23rd. They are doing a simulcast to, you know, 200-plus countries, all going to be at the same time. So depending on where you are, it might be 6 o'clock at night, could be 3 o'clock in the morning. But it's going to be broadcast at the same time for the whole world to see. And it's going to be, I guess, the biggest dramatic example of that ever, the biggest drama that's been simulcast. So I think that's a really cool thing because then that tells me that the people are saying not only is this like a publicity stunt kind of thing, but hey, this is for all of our fans all over the world at the same time. You don't have to worry about spoilers. You don't have to worry about any of that stuff because just get up at 2 a.m. and watch it if you really want to watch it. And I think that's great. And I honestly think that all of this discussion that we're having, if you put it on a global perspective, it becomes a lot more possible as far as the a la carte method. Allison, you mentioned a quote earlier about the difficulty for a niche market to kind of find its audience under an a la carte program, and it might price itself out of existence because it would have to be too expensive for people to subscribe, but it would have to be that expensive in order to survive for production quality. A 10 million viewer rating on a show for the network is great when we're just talking about America, but when you're talking about that on a global scale, that's a drop in the bucket. So I feel like if these a la carte options were available to people on a global market, now obviously there's a lot of legal things with distribution rights and territoriality
right.
and stuff.
I was going to say, like, there's so many international walls there.
Right.
Where people
can't... You don't have the same channels. Netflix isn't even the same.
Exactly. So
there's restrictions. But that's what I'm saying. It's going forward. So I think that the 50th anniversary special of Doctor Who is just a good example, and it might actually be a sort of a milestone that we look back to in the future and say, okay, they were able to do that. I'm sure it took a lot of haranguing to be able to get that approved, but it could be something going forward in the future that this content just becomes accessible to literally everyone.
Well, but doesn't that also have to not just become an opportunity, but in a way a necessity when dealing with, you know, we're seeing it from Americans like, haha, most of the TV comes from us. But when freaking right. Downton Abbey comes along and saunters over to the UK on the BBC.
Or
and
Sherlock.
Sherlock for sure, but I was thinking about Downton Abbey specifically because of a major event that happened in the third season.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And I hadn't gotten into Downton Abbey at that point, so it surprised me because I hadn't been paying attention to Downton Abbey, but had I been paying attention, that super major thing would have been revealed because that's how it gets out first in the UK, and you have to wait here to PBS unless you want to pirate it, right?
Well,
is that true? Wait, actually, can you get it on BBC America at the same time, or is it that still? Nope.
Okay. You gotta wait, right?
This is something that NBC came up against with the Olympics. If you remember all of the hullabaloo for the fact that they were not broadcasting events live necessarily,
right.
They were saving them for prime time, and people just like lost their minds over it because
the internet exists.
It wasn't even a Twitter problem. It was headlines from everyone. It was like CNN
headlines from NBC.com.
that was the best twist of that story. That NBC was spoiling its own programming.
I loved Brian Williams's like nightly newscast. Like, if you don't want to know, please turn your TV on mute
right
now, or look away from the television.
Don't make a sound. Yeah.
And NBC is going to be broadcasting the Premiership Soccer this year. And I think that their thing is like, we're going to broadcast it as it happens. So if the game is at 7 in the morning here on the East Coast, then it's at 7 in the morning. We're not going to save it until 3 o'clock in the afternoon or 6 o'clock at night or whatever, because people are already going to know the outcome.
Yeah, but soccer fans are crazy enough to do that. They'll wake up at any time to watch freaking soccer.
It's true. But I think that's interesting that NBC is actually catering to that because of what happened with the Olympics and the fact that people actually cared. Because that's the other thing about a la carte and bundling that I thought was an interesting point, is that even though people claim that, oh, I don't watch all these channels, according to surveys they've done, people like the idea that they have the channel.
Yeah, they're like a king on his cushion up there with just like everything available at their fingertips. Yeah,
right. And they said they like flat rate pricing because, you know, it's, you don't have to think about every single purchase you're making. Is this good? Do I need to purchase this or this? And you get all these things for, you know, thrown in as well. And they're saying how that has worked at amusement park where you used to pay for every ride.
Right.
And it's like, no, you just pay one fee and you get to do as many rides, as many different ones as you want. So people are still very beholden to that system. And I think that is probably the main thing that's really keeping bundling as the main source of how cable companies work. But going back to the Time Warner issue, I always think it's interesting that like every year this happens. it was AMC one year.
AMC
I think.
And DirecTV one year.
That was it. Yeah.
And DirecTV's in Time Warner's corner on this case too. They just threw their 2 cents into the ring unasked.
Well, and it's such bullshit that they're like subscribers. Like, please tell CBS that you want your show. It's like, no, fuck you. I paid for this service. This is your job. Don't make me do your job and take my channels away.
Well, here's the thing.
You sort this shit out, and I'm paying for this service.
But the negotiations have been that, so Allison, maybe you can correct me if I'm wrong on this, but the distributors had been paying a certain amount of basically just cash handed over to the cable channels, and they hadn't been doing that with the broadcast channels until fairly recently. And if it's my understanding that CBS really pumped up their fees that they wanted their distributors to pay to have access to this programming, because they're basically sitting in the number one spot broadcast, and they're just like, well, fuck you guys, if you want this, you're going to have to pay more for it. And what they want to do, what it looks like they're doing, is they're projecting like a quadruple bump up to like $1 billion a year in their fees that they're going to get, because they're trying to get away from this advertising model. They're trying to stop relying on advertising as their main source of income.
And the cable providers are getting nervous because people are already paying $100, $150 a month for
right.
these packages. And now, is it going to go up? Is it going to be even higher? But what's really interesting about this specifically is that in the past, it's always been resolved. In the 11th hour, mm-hmm. no channel has gone dark. They have run really irritating banner ads for like weeks prior. Please don't let this channel go away. But then with CBS, I don't know if this is true or not, but that it actually has gone black. I mean, it has actually gone now past the point where it's not on the air. And Dave, I think you also mentioned offline about the fact that you can't access content on CBS.com.
So Time Warner came out and they were like, it's okay, subscribers. You can still access CBS great content on CBS.com. And CBS came out and said, fuck off. They said, anybody that uses TWC to connect to the internet as like a broadcast subscription, we are going to block your content. So now it's just these two big babies that are just having a tantrum back and forth, and it's all the consumers that are suffering.
Meanwhile, the consumer goes to BitTorrent, says, fuck the both of you, I'm going to BitTorrent.
Yeah,
and
a smart customer would, hopefully.
To download my Mike and Molly.
What?
They're fat and they're in love. I have to know what happened.
Well, Allison just said, or under the dome, which is a really important point, too, for a couple of reasons. One, it's available on Amazon or Amazon Prime. Guess what? You have to wait a few days, but you can watch it.
And it's okay, because nothing's really happening on that show anyway.
No, ain't shit going on. But if you want to watch it, and I'm sticking with it out of some strange need to, I don't know, some suffering.
Just to read my reviews, right? Just to read my reviews.
Exactly. Okay. That's what I meant to say. Exactly. But I watch it on Fridays now. So I watch it Friday when it's available on Amazon Prime. Because I don't give a shit about the schedule. I don't care. I don't care that I have to wait a few days to watch that. That's not a big deal to me. But the other interesting thing is that Les Moonves, I think is how you say his name, the head of CBS, is like lauding Under the Dome as this like trailblazing effort in original programming in the summer, and it's like these huge numbers, and the fact that it's available on CBS.com and then a couple days later on Amazon is like this brand new thing that no one's ever thought of before, and it's the wave of the future, and it's the way that they're going to
he then followed up by saying, I can change the channel from this thing in my hand rather than going to the box and turning the channel myself. Truly,
it's just
the future
really
is
interesting
here.
how they spin that around and make it look like that was their sort of, you know, that's their creation too, and they're doing that out of the goodness of their hearts to bring it to as many customers as possible. I just found that pretty interesting.
CBS is the number one. I mean, the thing about Under the Dome is that it was originally conceived of as a miniseries.
Right.
And because of its success, because there's nothing else on in the summer on broadcast that's scripted, everyone's watching it. And so Les Moonves came out at TCA and said, guess what? There's going to be a season 2.
At least.
At least. Which is horrifying, because at the same TCA is what NBC, and I think ABC, I could be wrong, but they were touting limited series and miniseries as what's mm-hmm. going to redefine broadcast. It's going to be what makes them different, because they've got, like, NBC has got to just do something. But CBS is just like, you know, holding up middle fingers to everyone. It's like, we're going to do whatever we want, and we don't have to change because we keep making so much money. And so it's like you have on one end of the spectrum, you have Netflix, who is like, you know, going out there, producing original content and doing their thing. And then you have CBS, who's just like raking in so much money doing whatever they want to do. Because that's,
well, not whatever they want to do. They make lowest common denominator programming that takes no chances. And right. That is why. And they make stuff that appeals to the people who would still use Nielsen boxes. They do it for old people that aren't going to. No, I mean, sorry, the old person.
Yeah,
the
demographics,
being,
right.
Their demographic.
If you like NCIS. You might like NCIS LA.
Exactly. They're doing some
same thing.
Exactly. Their shows are either doctor shows, lawyer shows. Their comedies are very easy to digest. There's a reason they're number one. And yeah, they'll keep making that money. And yet at the same time, it feels like they're on the Titanic. It's a really nice ship, but it will go down eventually.
That's a great comment. Yeah, I think you're right.
Yeah, it really is. History has just kind of shown that any of those industries that, yes, you're successful, you've got a model that's been working for a really, really long time, but if you're blind to the fact that you can't see the world changing around you, I mean, I just got back from Detroit, so that is a very, very kind of like pertinent idea in my mind. You're just going to fail. I mean, if you don't change, if you don't adapt, if you don't take those chances, when you're in the position to be able to do that, that's the important point. Uh-huh. You know, they're in the position to be able to do something interesting and throw a little bit of money at doing something on the vanguard of these things, not just to take credit for shit that's been going on for 5 or 6 years already and tout it as the brand new thing. So it's unfortunate that they're able to do this and they're just playing the same game they always have.
Well, you mentioned the limited series, and I think that's something that's, I mean, Hatfields and McCoys was like a ginormous success, and so everyone has started doing the quote-unquote limited series, which is another word for miniseries. They're just trying to repackage it as something else. Mm-hmm. But FX is like really on the forefront with this because they came out at the TCAs and said that their Fargo series is 10 episodes. That's it. Mm-hmm. There's no more, no less. That's it. It's one season. And The Strain, Guillermo del Toro's The Strain, it's a trilogy of books. They're not going to stretch it out. Right. The head of FX said it will be somewhere between 39 and, like, I think, like, what, 70-something episodes? It's a very finite, like, when the story's over, the story's over. And I think that's kind of that's a better way of looking at it rather than you see Under the Dome as a success. And Les Moonves actually said, I don't see why they have to leave the dome anytime soon. So basically, we can stretch this out as long as possible, which is just the way – I mean, if you look – I mean, Lost is the perfect example of a show that, like, they were literally putting their characters in cages because they didn't know what to do, because they didn't know how long the show was going to go.
And so you can stretch, like, 3 episodes out of that, yeah.
Yeah, so they finally went to the network and was like, please give us an end date so we can, like, know how to finish our story. And they did, and that's when, like, the second half of season 3 turns around. So.
And look, man, if Under the Dome was actually good and I enjoyed watching it and shit actually happened, okay, I'd be sticking with them for a few years. That's fine. I originally wanted to see it just as a miniseries because I enjoyed the book. But, my God, it's painful to watch. But apparently everybody just enjoys doing it because there's nothing else on. So, I don't know.
It's the opposite model of HBO, who has allowed series like The Wire and Treme and even Girls and Enlightened and shows like that that have very, very low viewing figures. I think I realize I'm one of apparently like 250,000 people who've ever watched Treme.
Yeah, basically.
They let it go because it's critically acclaimed and they know that it's good. It's the same with The Wire. I mean, I think they said in The Wire's fifth season, the viewing numbers were under 1 million. People per episode, you know, more or less. And like Adam said, the numbers are always going to be probably wrong entirely. But for the most part, what the point is that they allow shows to cultivate, they allow them to develop, and then they give the creators an end date. And that's something that I think people more and more are really starting to crave, because even fans of Lost, and the finale has still left a bad taste in my mouth, but it's the sort of thing where you look back on it and you're like, oh, if it was just condensed, it would be one of the greatest shows of all time.
I don't think it's the condensed that it's not condensed enough. I think the problem with the Lost finale is a matter of choices, but that's a discussion that we've already had.
Not the finale, but the whole series.
Oh, the whole series?
If they had said you're going to have 3 seasons and then you're done, I think that would have forced them to condense it in such a way. And the same was true with Friday Night Lights with the first season, because they didn't think they were going to have anything after that. And it's just this like beautiful little encapsulated perfection of a season, because they thought that was the end. And then, you know.
Then actually their best seasons came from the constant thought that it would be their last season. So 3, 4, and 5 are all great, because they're like, we're all going to die. it's all coming to an end in Dillon, Texas.
See, but then there's things like The Killing. So the first season of that, when that came out, it was touted as a pretty much just a standalone miniseries, kind of, that, you
Not
know,
a mini,
you're gonna...
It was a series, but it was like, they say they never said this, but I swear I read
no,
they were
did.
Gonna tell you who the killer was in the end of season one.
Everyone
they absolutely did.
That. Yeah.
But then they saw that everybody was watching, and everybody, well, here's a clue to why everybody's watching, because they want to watch the murder mystery and find out who actually did it at the end, not this bait and switch so you can get another season out of it. But the interesting thing is, and Adam mentioned this a couple weeks ago, that, you know, the second season went through, it finally had some closure. And then the third season, from what Adam said and other people have said, has actually been pretty good. So that's one that kind of survived its own pitfalls. And
they
kind of
rebooted
like,
it for season three. But then you have shows like Homeland, where they take the storytelling of like basically like they live on – they're not drawing anything out. They're not saving this story for the season finale. They're going to do it. Like for better or worse, it's going to happen really fast, and there's just going to be a ton of twists and turns, which I think is great. They're not saving stuff.
It's a world without sweeps. That's the whole thing. Outside of network television,
is
you don't have to worry about sweeps anymore. And we haven't really talked about how, for those who don't know and may have heard the term sweeps, basically advertisers look at the numbers in November, February, and May as to appraise when to set the rates for their content. So all the networks are trying to chart out the big events that will get the highest viewership and therefore get to dictate a good advertising rate for the whole year.
Yeah, so another just kind of part of the antiquated system. Yeah.
And that's the thing, too, is that a lot of this really hinges on the advertisers themselves, because I don't think that they have quite figured out how to capitalize on the streaming model. They don't know how – I think I mentioned this to Dave not long ago, but when I first started watching shows that streamed on the network's own websites, ABC.com, CBS.com, all of the ad breaks were just house ads for those networks. They hadn't actually sold any of the space, because advertisers are very wary to, like, get on board with this kind of stuff. Mm-hmm. And they and this was another interesting thing that I didn't know, is that, you know, everyone talks about how edgy the content is on the premium networks, and even to some degree AMC and FX after 10 p.m., that being sort of the watershed time. And what I didn't know is that advertisers are actually the ones that dictate that broadcast be so buttoned up. Like, it's not because of the FCC. It's because advertisers don't want to advertise on a network that, you know, throws around the F-word or, like, shows nudity.
And yeah, that comes from that deregulation I talked about. Yeah.
They had a KFC ad right after an ad break on The Walking Dead when people were, like, tearing apart this human corpse. And it cut right into, like, an ad of KFC, like, eating chicken fingers. And they were really embarrassed.
Is it the one where they said, "I ate the bones," because that would be
it might have been. That's how it was. Because it was just a horde of zombies just ripping apart this corpse. And then it just smash cut right into.
I think we all just missed the days of, like, in the 1950s where an entire episode could just be, like, promoted by Geritol.
Well, but that's what they do on online. So if you watch stuff on Hulu, like Hulu Plus at least does this. I don't know if regular Hulu does, but they'll be like, you know, here's the rating, and then this episode brought to you by so and so, and then there's still at least two or three.
But they're
commercial
all for that one program.
That's the problem. Is they only have a handful of ads.
My favorite thing on Hulu, and I love it when this happens, is when it says, "Would you rather watch a 2-minute ad?" Or have ad breaks. I'm like, 2-minute ad.
And some of them are really good. They're like little mini movies, and they're actually fairly well done. I'm like, I would like to watch more from that production team. That is fine with me.
Like, then you have shows like 30 Rock that perfect the art of product placement. That is just fantastic.
Oh, yeah.
Subway.
Like Blimpy.
The Blimpy.
And a lot of
that's the thing. There's creative ways to do that. There are creative ways to get the money that you need to put these shows on. And the ones that are on the cutting edge of this are doing it. And the ones that are stuck in the past are struggling and you know, raising their fees and having the issues like TWC and CBS.
Sure. But you also have to note that there are some where it's the kind of advertising and it's the kind of demographic as well. And so, for instance, Mad Men gets a lot of credit because, like, their demographic are more affluent. So they're going to run ads for Lincoln cars. And going back to the model of something like a Netflix and or an HBO, you don't really need to know those demographics because, again, there's no advertising. So that's another thing, though, that we're not getting that data, not just in broad viewership of how many people are watching these Orange is the New Black or whatever. We don't know, you know, we can't even break that down, like how many women are watching Orange is the New Black, what age are they? And so how do you even determine and should that matter? I'm sure that matters to advertisers, but then again, they're not let on Netflix for now, and hopefully not for some time. But I mean, Hulu,
I'm sure
Hulu now has, but Hulu now has its original original programming as well, and they do have ads. So how do they work?
Well, here's the other interesting thing I think about the a la carte model and being able to actually fund the production of these things. My argument is, or at least one of my arguments for the a la carte model is, if you have a channel, say G4, which I enjoyed G4 when it was on for a number of years, I enjoyed the programming that I had on. It was very niche, very geeky, very specific to personally what I wanted to watch. They are recently changed over. They got bought out. They pretty much wiped out all their other programming or doing some sort of like – is it like a GQ channel now? I think it's like Gentleman's Quarterly type programming, which
–
whatever.
Esquire, maybe.
Okay, Esquire. Right. So now it's like an Esquire type programming, which is just like complete reverse from what they were doing before.
Rich white
dudes
only.
In an a la carte world, if you were paying, you know, $7 a month to watch that channel, you could put your money where your mouth is – and say, like, I'm still paying because I want to watch this programming or not. You know, if you don't like what's happening with the channel, you stop paying for it. In the world that we're currently in, the model that we have now, you can't really do that because you can't just say, well, I'm going to get rid of my other 162 channels because that 163rd one is no longer available. That money to channel to programming connection is not as strong in the bundled world as it could be in the a la carte world. So I really do think that it'd be better for consumers – and they'd be able to say, like, I'm giving you my money because I want to watch this programming. It's a very specific connection that they don't have in this bundled world, and we kind of lose that one-to-one connection. So that's just a point I wanted to bring up that I didn't see in any of the articles that we read, and I think that's something that's missed, but it could be interesting going forward too, that particular model.
Okay.
The end.
The end. Is there anything you guys wanted to add, Allison, Adam?
I think that, Matt, you mentioned something earlier about government regulation and how things became deregulated in, I think, 1996.
Yeah, 96 is when they dereg, yeah.
I think everything we've talked about, it's like, you know, we're sort of at this moment right now where there is innovation, but the old model is still generating a lot of revenue. Mm-hmm. And I think that things are changing. But I'm curious to see that if the real change will come from the innovation and from people actually wanting the change and putting, as Dave, you said, their money where their mouth, their eyes are, I guess, and watch, you know, Netflix and those sorts of things, or if it's going to come from government regulation, because there has been, you know, some consideration that they might need to step in and do what they did pre-1996 and regulate some of these wayward, crazy pricing points. So that to me will be the most interesting thing to say, sort of who is going to cause that change to happen first.
All right.
Go ahead, Adam.
I was going to say, just on kind of a content note, something I've been thinking about, I think that we're going to see a big hole open up in the world of cable dramas with Breaking Bad ends its final season this year and Mad Men will end its final season next year. And those two have been kind of like the flagships of, like, you know, they are what The Sopranos wrought. Like, they are the predecessors to that show, so there's got to be something else. So I think we're going to see a lot of networks trying to push forward, like, this is our, like, this is the new show that everyone has seen and everyone is talking about and wins all the awards. So I think that's going to be interesting to see kind of the arms race between the cable networks, because certainly ain't going to be The Newsroom.
Just one more comment from me. I've rambled on a lot today, but we didn't really talk about sort of the lesser sort of organized forms of content programming available online as well. There are, like, YouTube channels and things like that that are becoming sort of coalesced. So Machinima is starting to collect a lot of different original programming. I think Nerdist is actually kind of picking up channels here and there and putting them all together in one place for people. So that's kind of an interesting area to look at too, because it's very, very new, and it'll be intriguing to see what they kind of do with that in the future and if they can turn that into a more successful business model. But they're kind of in their infancy and they're growing as well. So that's another area to keep an eye out, especially if you haven't checked them out. That's an interesting place to look for very, very original programming and very, very niche content.
Absolutely. So yes, definitely an interesting business discussion of where TV is going, and we also got to kick under the dome, which was good. That also makes me happy.
I do it every week.
So, yes, indeed. Read Allison's recaps for what's not happening on Under the Dome. As for shows you should watch, Allison, why don't you lead us off?
All right, I have two. And one, well, I guess both actually, have to do with the news today that Peter Capaldi has been named the new Doctor Who, which I think is fantastic because he's a great actor. And if you have not watched The Thick of It, which is airing on Hulu, do yourself a favor and watch him and his foul-mouthed tirades as political spin doctor Malcolm Tucker. The entire series is on Hulu. And The Thick of It comes from the same creative team who does Veep. So if you like Veep, you'll probably like The Thick of It. The other side of that, though, is that it's very dense with English government humor. So if that's a little too much for you, just go to YouTube and watch clip reels of Malcolm Tucker's takedowns of his coworkers, because it's legendary stuff. Another Doctor Who connection, which is my second recommendation, is the series Broadchurch, which is coming up on BBC America this Wednesday, and I will have a review of that on Collider early this week. But it's a beautifully filmed and dramatically wrought crime drama. It stars David Tennant as a beleaguered investigator who uncovers the secrets of a small coastal town after a young boy's murder. The interesting thing about that series is that it was like Under the Dome, conceived of originally as a miniseries, but when it ran in England earlier this year, there was such a positive response to it, and not just the show itself, but the characters and the town and the setting, and people became so invested in it that they wanted more stories from the town. So it's actually picked up for a second season, which the creators said will not be a crime drama. It will just be about the characters. And that should convince you of just what an engaging drama it is. So look out for that. And then also, in the meanwhile, check out The Thick of It on Hulu.
I would also like to add that if you do like The Thick of It, you should watch In the Loop, which also features Peter Capaldi as Malcolm Tucker and is an awesome film. Okay, Dave, what about you?
I'm going to stick with the international choice of programming here and go with Moon Boy, M-O-O-N-E, Moon Boy. It's a fairly new series from creator Chris O'Dowd, and I'll just read you the synopsis here. Martin Moon is a young boy who relies on the help of his imaginary friend Sean, who's played by O'Dowd, to deal with the quandaries of life in a wacky small-town Irish family in the 1980s. It's just a fun, fresh take on just a family comedy. The ensemble is really good. There's a lot of just wacky characters throughout this little town. Chris O'Dowd plays this imaginary friend for this little boy it's kind of like a coming of age type thing for him. So there's a lot of stuff going on with school and with friends and with girls he doesn't quite understand, and he kind of uses O'Dowd as his imaginary friend as a sounding board. And the dialogue and the stuff they get away with is absolutely hilarious. And you wouldn't have even heard about it unless it was for Hulu, who I think has it as an exclusive series. So you can check out, I think the first 7 or 8 episodes are up on Hulu, and I believe they're releasing more as the weeks come. So head to Hulu and check that out.
Now, is that for all Hulu or just Hulu Plus subscribers?
I have it on Hulu Plus, so I don't know if it's just Hulu or not. But honestly, like Hulu Plus, so my package, my own personal bundle, is Netflix Instant, Hulu Plus, and Amazon Prime. So all told, on average, it's about $22 a month, and I just have this wealth of programming that I'm able to watch, especially these international things like Moon Boy. So I think that's worth the cost itself. But I don't know; it might just be Hulu Plus.
Okay, just asking. I wasn't like, come on,
come on,
money bags. Really, how much does this cost? Adam, what about you?
I'm recommending the Netflix series Orange is the New Black, which we kind of talked a lot about here. It comes from the creator of Weeds, Jinji Kohan, so I was kind of already – it was on my radar a little bit, but, you know, I wasn't sure if I was going to watch it. I really liked the first few seasons of Weeds, but I thought it kind of petered out. But, man, like, I was really pleasantly surprised when I started watching this. It's based on a memoir, so it's a true story of Taylor Schilling plays a woman named Piper Chapman who – gets imprisoned for transporting drug money, something she did 7-8 years prior, and currently she's kind of a waspy woman living in New York City, and she's engaged to a man played by Jason Biggs, and, you know, so it's kind of a story of like an unlikely woman, like this blonde unlikely woman going to a female prison. But it's an hour-long comedy drama, and it goes to these really dark places, but it's also really sweet without being too kind of sentimental. And the best part about this show is the ensemble. It's a true ensemble piece, and the ensemble cast here is fantastic, and it's telling stories that aren't being told on television and not really in movies either. It's got just a bunch of great Black and Latina actresses that, you know, get the chance to shine here, and you've got it's got a transgendered actress playing a transgendered character, and the stories are just really, they kind of dig deep, and they don't really skirt any issues or anything. Everything's kind of tackled head on, and it doesn't, you know, it, like I said, it doesn't veer into schmaltz or anything. And, you know, Taylor Schilling's good, but the performances all around are really just great. So I highly recommend you check it out. It's on Netflix. I'm sure you've heard people talking about it, and it is definitely worth the hype.
Okay.
And it has a lot of nudity.
Yes, there is female nudity. It's very
least,
like glaring in the pilot.
Yeah.
If you
can't
convince you, there's a lot of female nudity.
Really, I wouldn't say there was that. I've seen shows.
It's front loaded.
Towards the
not
beginning.
To me, it's front loaded. It doesn't go on. We're not talking Game of Thrones here. That's what I'm saying.
It's not pervy.
Right. That too.
Also that. Yes.
I meant pervy. Like Game of Thrones nudity is pervy.
It is.
Very 12-year-old George R. R. Martin.
Unnecessary.
Yeah.
Okay. Wow, we got in some George R. R. Martin shots in there as well. Wasn't expecting that.
Hooray.
Okay. My recommendation was, before the show, I was like, I was kind of at a loss, and I was like, I'll recommend The Critic, because it's a great show, and everyone should watch it. And they should. But in our conversation, I think the show that I am going to recommend, for various reasons, is Spaced. Edgar Wright's mm-hmm. Spaced, which yes. played between 1999 and 2001. And one of the reasons I'm recommending it is because Wright's new film, The World's End, opens on August 23rd, and you should totally go see it. It's great. But this is sort of where he started in terms of his first major thing. This is where he, Simon Pegg, and Nick Frost got together working. And the premise of the show is that Simon Pegg and Jessica Stevenson play these two 20-somethings in London, and they both need a place to live. And so they go to this they find this flat, but the landlord is, they have to put on the pretense that they're a young professional couple. And so they have this whole story worked out, and then it turns out to not really matter that much. And in the course of the series, on another series, you could see it as some sort of constant tension, like, will they get found out? Will they not? And then it's just, on Spaced, it quickly becomes dropped so that a lot of the episodes can just have this fun genre thing. So most of the episodes will take something like a kind of a serious, not a serious thing, but a relatable issue, like trying to find a job or dealing with an ex, and then just throw in all these genre elements into it. There's one great episode where it just speaks to the wonderful craziness of the show, where it's like this huge gun battle, except everyone's just using their fingers, but it's shot as if it were just this epic John Woo style shootout, and it's fantastic. And you can really see Edgar Wright sort of develop his directing chops and really establish a style. And also there's the comedic tone and just all the talent, both from Pegg and Stevenson and Frost and their co-stars. And it's just a really fun series. And in our discussion, I was reminded about how it didn't come on it. Edgar Wright and Simon Pegg, they started to come to success with Shaun of the Dead in 2003, and people were like, oh, I want to see what else they've done. And it's like, there's this great series, Spaced. Where can I see it? Well, if you're in the U.S., you can't. It's not on DVD. Well, it did become on DVD in the U.K., except that's a Region 2 DVD, and it's locked, so you couldn't import it and watch it here. You would actually have to have a DVD player that could watch the show. You'd have to buy basically a region-free or region-unlocked player. So there's that issue. So then in 2008, it finally came to the U.S., assuming at this point you hadn't just bootlegged the damn thing and watched all 14 episodes. Again, British television, pretty short, pretty easy to watch. It's half an hour each episode. But that's sort of the thing. It's those old boundaries. And now, because I remember being in college, I'm like, man, I really want to watch this show, but I'm not going to buy a unlocked DVD player just to do it. And now you can just watch it on Netflix Instant. No big deal.
It's also on Hulu. And by the way, Moon Boy is also on Hulu, not Hulu Plus.
Nice.
Yeah. So there's
Hulu or Hulu Plus. Yeah. So either
right,
way.
Right, right.
So that's just how far we've come. And there's a great show, and you couldn't see it, and there were difficulties and obstacles, and now it's just like, see it whenever you want, wherever you want. But I highly recommend checking out Spaced if you haven't seen it. Okay, so that's our show for the day. Allison, thank you so much for joining us and sharing your TV wisdom, as always.
Thanks for having me.
Next week, we will be talking about Elysium and other matters. So if you want to keep – I don't know. Like, there's so many places to take Elysium, but also I don't want to retread. We kind of talked about science fiction a lot last year with Prometheus. And not that I'm against talking sci-fi, but we'll try to figure out an angle to it.
Rage against the 1% for probably at least an hour solo if you want.
I saw your Twitter fight. That was fun.
Oh, that was amazing. I don't have enough entertainment trolls. I got to get into financial debate trolls, too. That was fun. Good times.
I'll give you some of mine. All right. If you want to keep up with this podcast, speaking of Twitter, if you want to keep up with this podcast, you should follow us on Twitter and troll us, whatever. It doesn't matter. My Twitter handle is Matt Goldberg. Adam, where can we find you on Twitter?
Adam Chitwood.
Dave?
At Dr. Claw, MD.
And Allison?
At Keen TV.
And how do you spell Keen? Just because...
K-E-E-N-E-T-V.
That's how we do it on the radio. All right, I have to spell it out for people. But you should follow Allison. You should follow all of us because we're full of insight and wisdom. All right, thanks for listening, everyone, and we'll be back with you next week.